Are you mutts about dogs? Well, welcome then to the Rescue Dog Love Podcast, a place where we celebrate the rescue community and the rescue dogs that have enriched our lives. I'm your host, Yamini, and this is my rescue queenie. Hello, everybody. Welcome back after way longer away than I intended to the Rescue Dog Love Podcast. Happy Halloween if you guys are listening day of. Today's episode is all about a very spooky subject. Kids, or rather, the decision of not having them and having dogs instead. So today, I am sharing our conversation with Blair. She's the runner of the account Dig Dog Mom. We chat about the quote-unquote controversial decision of not having children and the judgment that can come out of that choice. Also, we talk about a term that I think is interesting. Why is the term dog mom or dog parent so controversial? Listen in for all this and more. Thanks for tuning in and be sure to share your thoughts with me on Instagram at Rescue Dog Love Pod. Hello, Blair. Welcome back to the Rescue Dog Love Podcast.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be back.
We already did this back, I don't know how long ago, like long freaking time ago. So I think it's good for us to just connect again, talk about dog ownership as it is now in full 2023.
Yeah. Updated.
Is it cold where you are?
Unfortunately, no. It is. It has been a very warm fall so far. It's actually been in the 90s.
Yeah.
Here in Sacramento. So it is supposed to cool off this week, though. I think it'll be in the 70s. I'm hoping, praying that means cooler weather is on the way because I'm a cold weather fan.
Fair. We just had a huge dip. It was so hot. And now all of a sudden it's freezing. Ugh. Not actually freezing, but like as close as
yeah, cold.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. That sounds nice.
It is nice. I just have to remember to take out my winter clothing and ideally get the sweaters for the dogs back out, which is my favorite part yes. of it all.
I love the most important part of the season.
Yes, exactly. Just seeing a lot of cute sweaters on dogs. All right. Before we get into your channel, I always love to start off just hearing more about your little fur family.
Yeah. So we have three fur kids, if you will. We have two dogs and a cat. June is the eldest. She is 5 years now. We adopted her when she was about a year old. At the time, we still had our old grandpa dog, Coates, and he was old. We called him retired at that point because he really just slept, was basically his beautiful life, was just sleeping all the time, which to be fair is actually how he spent most of his life. He was a very lazy dog, but we adopted June after my dog, Mia, had passed away. And it became apparent very quickly that she, I don't want to say needed a dog playmate, but she just really thrived with a dog playmate. And Toads was a little too old. He didn't really want to play. June didn't really want to play with us, like as humans. She really wanted to play with dogs. So the joke is we got her a dog. Which is Margot. And Margot is 4. She's an Australian Shepherd. Both of them are rescues. So June is like a super mutt mix. And Margot is pure Australian Shepherd. But she was adopted from a breed-specific rescue. And she's 4. And then we have Clark, who I guess is technically the eldest. Because I got him in 2012. But he's just sort of the, like, we call him the mafia boss. Because he kind of keeps everybody in check. And very much a mama's boy. Very much a mama's boy. He tolerates my husband. Like, sometimes I'm like, oh, he's not that old. And I'm like, oh, no, he's 11 years old. Had him for a long time.
Clark is your cat, right?
Yes. I'm sorry. I just assumed everybody knows Clark.
No, it's fair. Cats are so funny that way because they just, like, their age doesn't really show in the same way dogs do.
He's been the same cat. I call him little shit a lot because cats, man, like dogs, I don't know. It's people are like, oh, well, like cats, you have to earn their respect. And like, that's kind of true, but it's also like cats are just hard to understand. Like they will complain without letting you know why. You know, they'll start peeing on stuff and you're like, what has changed? What has upset you? Why are you peeing on stuff? Is it medical? Is it like I switched laundry detergents? Like, is it fall is coming? Like, what's happening? It's not as easy. I feel like understanding cats is a little more mysterious. But I love Clark. He's super cuddly with me and he sleeps curled up next to me almost every night.
So sweet.
It's cute, but also really hot. Like, don't touch me.
But he only does that to you and not your husband.
Correct. Correct. I think he has like maybe sat on my husband's lap like a total of like four times in the, you know, 9 years that we've been together.
Clark's just like, I guess I will tolerate the fact that you are here.
And I always joke that Clark has like raised a bunch of dogs because I got him as a kitten when I had my first dog, but then I fostered a lot and he was always like the cat test for dogs. So, I mean, of course, when I would foster, I'd always check, like walk by the cat room and see how, because you can kind of tell if a dog is like, is this a toy or like, I want to eat this.
Yeah.
Like, there's a distinct difference. He would always keep my fosters in check. And then when we got June and Margot, you know, he kept them in check too.
I always say that, yes, like obviously the cat test is important, but I think the only dynamics I've ever seen where dogs and cats like really coexist and get along is if the cat is not scared of the dog at all. And even if the dog is a little scared of the cat, that's even better. Like you just need the dynamic to be that the cat rules the whole house.
100%. And that is totally how Clark is. Like he does not run from dogs unless he will run from a dog because he knows it'll get the dog in trouble. So like he would do that sometimes with my fosters where he would like bolt and the foster would chase him. And it's like, you could just tell he knew, like, you're not supposed to do this and I'm going to get you in trouble for it.
That sounds like very cat behavior, like trolling. He's like,
I had fostered a dog once that was returned to the shelter and accused of killing someone else's dog, which the shelter staff didn't fully believe because they tested it with our dogs and it was like super fine. And so I fostered her and that dog loved Clark. Like they would wrestle and play. And I was like, see, she was like some big bulldog, like American bulldog type mix. And you know, Clark's a big cat. He's been on a diet for like 3 years. He's like 16 pounds. But yeah, he's always been so great with my fosters. And even our friend, we have a friend, some friends who have a dog and they were like, we did not think she was cat friendly, but her and Clark get along. So all goes back to that fear thing.
Agreed. I just think it's like, it's cat dependent. You just need a cat who is just like, nah, you're not getting away with this. Because even my girl Queenie, like sometimes will try and chase cats off the street, even though like she's probably smaller than some of these cats. But then yeah, with my friend's cats, like, you know, I'll still keep her on leash and stuff, but I could tell that she's just like, okay, no, this is your house.
Not worth it. Yeah. June's the same way. Like June wants to chase cats when we're out walking around and she'll play with Clark, but Clark, he plays kind of mean. So like she kind of wants to play, but then when he starts really playing back, she gets really scared.
Let's talk a bit about June. What is her personality like with you guys, with the dog?
So June is super sweet. We call her the angel. She's like the wholesome first child who like never does anything wrong. She can be a little bit aloof with strangers, but once you're in, she's like the sweetest dog. She looks like a little fox, but she'll do this thing where she'll like put her ears back and her eyes get really big. It's like Puss in Boots, like that like baby face, but like she literally can do that with her face. She's very independent. We did a DNA test on her and she's mostly chow, like 30% chow. Like chow, boxer, pit bull, lab, husky, German shepherd. So she's kind of got like an independent spirit where she like likes to sniff and wants to explore, but then like she's also the one who really wants to like snuggle on the couch or like really likes to she wants to like put her front paws on you and then like use you to stretch, like as like leverage to stretch. And then like her happiest thing is to sit in front of you with her paws on your chest and then you can just like scratch her sides. That's when she's the happiest. So she's like the sweet angel dog. And then we have Margot, who is also very sweet but also very derpy. And Margot was such a strange dog because we got her when she was like 5 or 6 months old, so still in her puppy phase, but was like the chillest puppy ever, even for an Australian shepherd. I mean, I don't want to say she didn't have any energy, but like was just super low maintenance, very calm, never chewed on anything, like very laid back, like the calmest puppy ever, almost to the point of being a little boring. Where I was like, I did my research. I wanted an Australian Shepherd because I wanted kind of like a bouncy, like engaged, you know, energetic kind of dog. And I ended up with this like super laid back. And she was also kind of aloof for the first really like year or so that we had her. And it's like the older she gets, the goofier she gets. It's like she's reverse aging. Like she becomes more puppy-like as she gets older. So now she's like what I think of as like the quintessential Australian Shepherd, where it's like all wiggles and like her little nub tail and her whole booty shakes. And she's the one who, like, if we sleep in too long in the morning, which I say sleep in too long, like 8 or 8:30, she's merciful. She'll like dive into bed and it's all just like wiggly and like the whole bed starts to vibrate. And so she's the goofy one. And both of them, they love dogs. Margot loves Pedro more than June. June is just a little bit more like, I have to get to know you before we're friends. Whereas Margot's just like, everybody is a friend.
And is Margot like pretty drivey too? Like likes to do
tricks?
No.
I mean, she enjoys training and she's very thoughtful. thoughtful with training and learning tricks, but I would say she has zero drive, and she especially has zero herding drive. I got, like, when we were back in Texas and we had a yard, I had one of those herding balls, which is like a, it's like a big red ball that dogs can like herd around, and she like chased after it once and then like never went after it again. The only time you see like a little bit of instinct show through is when my husband and I will walk the dogs together. If like we start to separate a little bit, she very much wants us to stay in a group, and that's kind of as instinctual. But she like zero drive, super low energy. She's very good with the flow, so it's actually really nice, because like if we want to go for a hike, like she's up for it. If we just hang around the house, up for that too. She's super, whatever we want to do is fine with her. She does get a little zoomy and crazy, and her and June will like wrestle and stuff. I know she is smart, but sometimes it's like a little dumb.
Definitely not what you would associate with an Aussie Shepherd. Yeah,
like definitely. And I mean, she's luckily, she's like very healthy. We did the Embark test on her too for the health side of it, because since she's a rescue and like Australian Shepherds are very poorly bred, I just wanted to make sure she didn't have any like genetic illnesses to be aware of. And everything turned out really healthy. Structurally, she's very sound. Her story is like a little bit murky, where like I think she was purchased by a breeder who, I think it was like an older person who was trying to establish a breeding program, and then got sick, and his family had to like get rid of all the dogs. And there was like, the rescue took in like 9 Australian Shepherds, all under the age of 1. And so she went from where she was born to a breeder, to a temp house, to a foster house, to my house, all in a span of 5 or 6 months. So I also assume that's why she was kind of like aloof for the first year of her life. She's like, oh, I can't get attached. And so I think all of the Australian Shepherds that came out of that home were small. So they're not actual mini American Shepherds. They were Australian Shepherds, but they were very small, and they were all very low energy, low drive. So I think if I had to guess, sleuthing through these clues, somebody was breeding like smaller, home-oriented Australian Shepherds, like looking for low energy family dogs, is my guess.
That's interesting. And yeah, even when, you know, I know obviously a lot of like trainers and a lot of experts out there really focus on the breed, but you really never know nowadays. I think like the breeding situation is so strange, and people are looking for so many different traits that you can end up getting the chillest Aussie Shepherd ever, which to me sounds perfect, honestly.
Yeah, she really is. Like, in hindsight, I'm really grateful that she's as chill as she is, because especially since we like moved from Texas to California and stuff, like she's been able to weather all of that change really well. I feel like it gives you a lot of grace as a dog owner.
Yes. And I think a lot of folks want the positives of like a high drive shepherdy dog, and then are faced with the hard parts of it. And it's a lot. I'm glad you and, you know, Margot just got to just like hang out. And I feel like what you said about her being aloof too, it sounds like she's just like getting more and more comfortable every year.
Totally.
And just like going a little bit, taking some more little hyper risks.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's funny, because like other people are like, oh wow, she's so energetic. And I'm like, is she? So like, it could just be too, like my threshold is because she is bouncy and she gets excited and she gets her zoomies. But like, I think if you have encountered like a high energy Aussie or border collie or something, and you see that work ethic, then I'm like, no, Margot is not.
Yeah.
High energy. She is energetic. She is not high energy. There is a distinct difference. And yeah, I think a lot of people get a breed like that because they're like, oh yeah, it's going to go running with me, and I'm going to like train it all these tricks, which is great. Except when you realize you have to do that every day. Like, you can't just do that once a week or, you know, a couple times a month. It's like, you got to do something with those kind of dogs every single day, which for me, I knew that and I was fine with it because dogs are like my hobby. Now, of course, I'm like, oh, maybe this all turned out for the better because it's given me a lot more flexibility.
And do you have June's rescue story as well, or do you know anything about
my first dog that I ever adopted? Her name was Mia, and I got her through a rescue called, at the time it was called Tracy's Dogs Rescue. And Tracy, who was the founder of the rescue, the city shelter in the city of San Antonio had an overflow space. It was called the Brooks facility. It was widely believed that like if a dog went there, it was basically a death sentence because it like wasn't open to the public. It was super hard to find. Dogs who went there just were never seen. And so Tracy would go to that facility and film dogs and post them on YouTube so that people would adopt them, and then she would help facilitate the transport. So I got my first dog from her. I had a really good relationship with her. My first dog was like my heart and soul dog. And then when she passed, I really wanted to, first of all, I knew, I was like, I can't live without a dog. I mean, I would recommend people give themselves some time to grieve, but like also if you just know, like you need that routine, like I needed the routine of like letting a dog out and feeding a dog, you know what I mean? So I was like, well, I'll foster until like the right dog comes along. So I reached out to Tracy, and there was another dog I was going to go. She had her rescue, and she also had her house where she was building like a quarantine facility for like dogs who were either in quarantine for mange or like when they were there for their spay and neuter. It was kind of like a little medical facility. She had a dog that I was interested in. And so I went to her house to meet this other dog. June at the time was called Barbie. She had been picked up off the streets of Harlingen, which is a town along the Texas-Mexico border. When she was picked up, she was in really rough condition. So she was like completely hairless. She was half her weight. I think she was a little bit under a year. So part of that could have been developmental, but she was like 15 pounds. She's now 30 pounds. So she was super, super skinny. And she had a condition called entropion, which is where her lower eyelids were growing into her eyeballs. Not dangerous, but obviously very uncomfortable. Tracy pulled her into the rescue, got her cleaned up. got rid of her mange, got some weight on her, and then fixed her eyelid issue. So they called her Barbie because of the cosmetic surgery. So they thought it was kind of like a superficial name, which has not aged well with the Barbie movie. Okay, I understand that. Barbie is no longer a superficial concept. And so originally I wasn't interested in June because she was listed as 15 pounds and I wanted like a solid medium sized dog. But then when I met her in person, I was like, oh, she's 15 pounds because she was extremely malnourished. Even at the time I met her, I think she was probably closer to 20 or 25 pounds. Just a couple weeks after my heart dog had passed away, and I had gone out with a volunteer who was letting a group of dogs out for a potty break, and we were sitting on the stairs, and June just like sat on the stairs with us and was just like so sweet and so gentle. Mia had been she was high drive, very high energy, very in tune to me, like would have starved herself if I asked her to, like was very tuned into me. And I loved, selfishly, of course, I was like, yes, this is what I want in a dog. But June was just so sweet. And I was like, this is what I need right now. Like, this is what I need. So I was like, this is the one. I'm going to take her home. I want to foster her. Of course, like a week later, I was like, no, I'm keeping this dog. And so that's how we ended up with June, is she was kind of a foster fail, but like it was a foster situation where we were intending to adopt at some point. And she fit in so well. She was so easy, very quiet. Again, she was kind of aloof when we brought her home. So she wasn't really snuggly, but it made her like easy to integrate into our household. Now, of course, she's like super snuggly and I love it. The lady who ran the rescue gifted her to me. Her rescue has since changed because she went through this really awful divorce and had her rescue stolen from her. So now she runs Tracy's Paws Rescue. They're still doing really incredible work. Really excited to like go through that same rescue that I'd gotten my first dog from. And I always say like Tracy has a way. In a place like South Texas where you have such a high pet overpopulation problem, like trying to choose dogs for rescue is almost impossible because like even if you only looked at like healthy, friendly dogs, like you cannot save them all. There is just such a high volume. And I always say like she has this like special gift of being able to choose like, I don't want to say the best dogs, but like she just always chooses like even if they're maybe a little sickly or like she just knows dogs that need rescue. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's unfortunately really common for folks, especially in those communities. I know that the rescue that I've worked at, they all worked with like Texas partners and Tennessee partners because we're very lucky that parts of Canada don't have like a dog overpopulation problem. It's easy to bring in dogs from populations that need it, but it's so easy to overextend yourself and just be like, I'm accepting every dog that appears at our shelter. I'm just like cruising around looking for them. And then you're like overwhelmed, can't afford them. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And it's a real struggle because, I think people expect like, oh, well, you're a rescue. You love dogs. So you'll just take every dog. And it's like, it's physically not possible. Like rescues do not have the houses or the resources, the dog food, the vet care. It's just not possible. And that's why one of the things I get really frustrated about is when people will pour so much time and money into like a hospice care situation. Every dog deserves a great chance, but spending $10,000, $15,000 on a 12-year-old dog when there are puppies or dogs that are 1, 2, 3 years old that are like perfectly healthy and need, like, it just seems like such a gross misuse of resources. But I also get it because like, when you're there in the moment, some of those hospice cases are the most like pull on your heartstring cases. And I mean, of course, you also have rescues that sort of like use that to their advantage. That's like a fundraising technique, is to pull, like to get those like pull on your heartstring cases. So yeah, it's definitely that's a whole different podcast episode.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I've always just said, figure out what you care about And I feel like you had a good relationship with the person who ran this rescue. You obviously had a great experience with Mia, and then you just wanted to continue it. And I think like you got to do what works out for you. And obviously it worked out with June really well. And I was going to say it earlier too, I don't know, whenever I fostered an aloof dog, they're always the best because they are all over you right away. There's trouble coming.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Also, I'm such a selfish dog owner. I want my dog to love me more than everybody else.
Oh, I'm the same. It's bad.
Aloof dogs are like that. Like those are the dogs that you form a bond with and then like you feel special around them because they're not like that with everybody. Whereas the dog that's like all over you to begin with, they're all over everybody, you know? So it's like, no, I want the dog that like we have a special relationship.
I know what you mean. I think Queenie's a bit like that. And I mean, Boss was like that with my ex. And I feel like that's why I was like, I know every foster likes me, but I need my own thing going.
Yes.
But it's cute. I love that dogs are able to do that, you know?
Like if I were to go buy a dog from like a reputable breeder, it would be a dog breed that has a one person type of personality. Like that would be an intentional choice on my part.
It's like a Shiba or like,
yeah,
like a Chow Chow. Yeah. Like you were saying,
a Dalmatian, you know,
just be like, this dog is only mine. Let's chat a bit about how you started your dog account. What brought you to start the Dink Dog Mom account?
Early on, it was just June's account. Like after I had decided to officially adopt her, I started the Instagram with June the Fox Dog, and that was her handle. And then I got Margot. And so I thought about like different things to change it to. And I, around that same time that we adopted Margot, it might've actually been a little bit before I adopted Margot, I decided to start a dog blog because I love writing. It's sort of like my creative expression. And obviously I love dogs. And so I was like, oh, this is like a perfect passion project to have a blog about like dogs and dog mom stuff. And so I started it and it was called Dogs Are a Girl's Best Friend. It was really about, you know, being a dog mom, right? It's like dog ownership, but specifically like for a dog mom. It was great. But over time, I kind of like, I guess probably because you always hear about like, who's your audience? Or like, what's your niche? And like, who are you writing to? And it was like, it felt so broad of a topic that I like didn't really know. Like sometimes I got overwhelmed with what to write about because it was like, there was like almost too many topics. And like, what did I want to focus on? And were they even related? And around the same time, I had come across some child-free content, child-free by choice, which I have been child-free by choice essentially my whole life. I kind of, as a kid, I thought like, one day I'll want kids. Like when I grow up, I'll want kids because that's what you do. You grow up and you have kids. And then finally, it was like, I think I was in maybe my 20s where I was like, maybe I just don't want a kid. Like I feel like at this point, like mid-20s, not that you have to have kids in your 20s, but like you would think like by your mid-20s, you would be like, all right, I will find a partner and I'm ready to have kids. No, like I was like still like, it's not even like I'm not ready for kids right now. It's like, I can't see myself ever having kids. So I had always kind of been child-free by choice, but I had never heard the language around it or seen the community or had even thought of it being a community. Because it was just not something I talked about. Part of it too is just like, I have two older sisters. They're both married. They have kids. So like my parents aren't asking me about kids. I just wasn't around that kind of pressure. But I was like, oh, I love this. Because like, that is me. Like I am child-free by choice. You don't have to have kids. And specifically like, I'm over here raising dogs, not babies. I had been thinking about changing my, I guess, brand for a little bit. And there's the term DINK, which is dual income, no kids. And it is like a for real marketing demographic, right? Like it is a real term.
Disposable income. Lots of disposable income. Yeah.
You know, it can be anybody from young, it could be young married couples who don't have kids. It could be young single people who, because you don't have kids, like you're in a decent job, like you're making, you have enough money to have a certain level of disposable income. It's also empty nesters, you know, like people whose kids have moved out of the house. They are also dual income, no kids. And so it's this whole marketing demographic of, it's a really, I feel like, undertapped demographic, to be totally honest, because it's this group of people who have extra money and for ways to spend it. And I thought about it, especially in terms of dog ownership, because I feel like it's really the disposable income, no kids, people who are like really getting into dog nutrition or like really getting their dogs the like over the top dog bed. You know, they're the ones who really like whose dog to become a hobby, basically, is what it is. Mom, I mean, how beautifully does that roll off the tongue? Yeah. So it's like, this is it, my new brand. And so I rebranded everything. This was 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago is when I rebranded. And it's been great. Like it certainly has stirred up some controversy, but which honestly unexpected to me. In hindsight, that sounds so naive, but I think it's resonated with a lot of people who don't want kids, but do love having dogs. And I talk a lot about kids are not necessarily a substitute or a replacement for kids. It's not like they become surrogate children. Dogs are their own thing. And like, it still gives you this outlet to like, there's something satisfying about the responsibility, care, and compassion that goes into, you know, being a dog owner. I think all of that is very satisfying in a similar way that it's satisfying to raise kids, but they're still very different things, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think too, like the differences make sense for that kind of more hobby mentality. I really don't think people who have kids think about it as a hobby.
As a hobby?
There's a lot of responsibility on both ends, but I'm always going to be like, the responsibility with kids is beyond. Your dog is never going to turn 18 and live their own separate life from you. Your dog is always, yes, they're going to go through stages of change, but those stages are not going to be as extreme. But yeah, I do want to like kind of get into that controversy because I think it's tied into like why it's so important.
Yeah.
For you and me to kind of take that identity of like child is by choice and just like, yeah, I guess I'll put it out there. I have my own interesting journey, I guess, with like wanting kids or not wanting kids. As a kid, I feel like I never wanted to get married. That was just like never that interesting to me. I was always very like, I don't know. I think I was just like a little adult and I was like, I'm going to be the most successful in my career. I'm going to, you know, I wanted to be a ballerina.
Yep.
I would be the best ballerina in the world. If I was going to be a vet, I was going to be like saving like lions and stuff. I wanted to be a famous author at one point. You know, those were my dreams.
I love it.
Like, I think, you know, grew up with the Spice Girls, a lot of girl power kind of vibes. I always like thought kids were really cute. I really liked them growing up. And then I think as I got less exposure to them in university, I just was like, now that they're not around, I don't know how cute I find.
Are they that cute?
And now it's kind of come around where, you know, I have lots of friends who have kids and hang out with them. And I enjoy spending time with little people a bit more than I used to, but doesn't hit the same. I can hang out with like a trillion dogs and they can all be misbehaving and driving me crazy and I'll still be okay. And I know that first of all, you know, the short term hanging out with kids is just not something that gives me the same joy and passion that I know it does others. And then secondly, the responsibility for me is not worth what I'm sacrificing.
Oh yeah. I think people are always wanting to pit sort of like kids versus no kids as like who's going to be the winner? Like who's the best lifestyle? It's really like, there is no just like universal best. There's just what's best for you. I went from actually like as a kid, I did not like kids. Like I babysat a couple times and I was like, I freaking hate this. I never want kids. This is terrible. I assumed that would change because it's such a pervasive idea that you grow up and have kids. I just kind of was like, oh, I guess I'll grow out of this. And I just never did. But I used to say that I hated kids. Like I did not like kids. And then really once my niece was born, just like the eldest of my sister's kids, that's the first time I was even really around small people consistently. And I loved it. Like I love my niece to bits. I love my nephews. I love spending time with them. I love buying birthday gifts for them. I love hearing about their lives and what they're doing. But I feel like spending time with them empties my cup, but in a very satisfying way.
Yeah.
But it's like, I would go home after spending time with them. Like, okay, like I need to recharge now. Like that was wonderful and I am satisfied, but I need to recharge. Whereas I feel like being around dogs fills my cup. And it's not because the kids are bad or like, you know, I was gonna say, it's not that they're hard. I mean, they are hard, but like, it's not because they're like energy vampires or anything. It's just for me personally, it takes a lot of energy out. It doesn't give me energy. I think for some people, spending time with their kids, even if it's exhausting, probably fills their cup.
Yeah. I really like that distinction. It's kind of like how people talk about like extroversion versus introversion. It's not necessarily if you're shy or not. It's about what gives you that energy, what fills your cup, what makes you happy. Like I like staying home and binging some TV all on my own, but I love being with my friends. I love being with people.
Yeah.
Definitely is what like makes me happy. Same with dogs. The responsibility of kids, I will never underestimate, is 20 times what the investment in dogs is. And less like the idea of, first of all, you know, the time commitment, like 18, not, you know, we say 18 years. That's way more than 18 years, especially in today's today's economy, and also your kids are your kids for life. You know, I'm 33 and my relationship with my parents is still important and needs sustenance and like effort and all those things. And then, of course, the sleeplessness, getting sick, being up all night, dealing with really, really intense questions and teaching them about the world and how you know, complicated it is. Like, those are amazing things that take so much strength and take so much like intense work. And, you know, I'd just rather do training with my dogs.
I think about it in terms too, like you mentioned the responsibility of kids. And I think a lot about, you know, your kids hopefully outlast you. And so like you are shaping the next generation of humanity. And that is a huge responsibility to me, you know, and I think like the reality is no parent is perfect. Like you will mess up, you will in some way damage your kid that they're going to have to figure out later. Like that is just inevitable and it's okay. And like, it's because, you know, life is not perfect. And for me, I recognize that as like an incredible achievement and a beautiful impact, but I want to make an impact somewhere else. So for me, like I would rather make an impact through my job or by building a community or writing. There's more ways to make an impact than just kids. And kids are very, very important, of course. But if it was only about your children, like you need other people who are working on the community aspect, who have the bandwidth to focus on other issues so that your kids have a good space to grow up into.
Absolutely. Very political to have children, you know, not the more obvious way, obviously, but also just like you are raising the future. You are creating, you know, beings that are going to be out there and make impacts and make changes. And I mean, it's pretty amazing and a lot of pressure. And I don't know, I think too, you know, I feel like every friend listening to me would be like, oh my God, you'd be an amazing mom or dad. But like, I just feel like I know that a lot of my negative qualities would come out if I raise a kid. I don't know. I just feel like I have a lot of, you know, Virgo tendencies. I like things to be perfect. I'm very hard on myself. And like, that's something I'm working on. And the idea of having a kid and doing what I do to myself to someone else, even if it is subtle, it's a lot. Obviously, it could not happen. I could be like much nicer to my kid than I am to me. But I don't know that. I can't imagine like
I also...
school. What if I have a kid who's like not very good at school and I have expectations of them? What if I have expectations of them in this that way? It's just a lot to like imagine what I would be like. And sometimes I'm like, maybe it's best for me just not to put that on anyone.
Yeah, I think it's also like the people who really want to have kids are then committed to making it work. So I think if you were the kind of person where having kids was like your dream or whatever, like that's what you really wanted to achieve, you don't have to do that work if you don't want to. And I think that's something that people really struggle to accept, is that like, just because I don't value raising kids doesn't mean I think people raising kids don't have value. Like just because it's not valuable in my life doesn't mean it's not valuable in your life. And I think people just really get threatened if somebody else's values don't align with their own. And feel like it's a competition. And it's like, no. Like they're just different values. Like there's no right or wrong or better or worse. And like my experience doesn't invalidate your experience. It's just different.
And it's interesting. I mean, I think parenting has a lot of crucial concepts around it. Obviously, there's like different styles of parenting, different styles of like how you relate that to your world. And I don't know, I've even noticing just like to bring it big, you know, the fact that things like trans rights are being equated to like child safety. It's very easy to pull on that vulnerability parents have. And I think that's where people are used to like having alarm bells of anything different. And I think, you know, not to the benefit of like just general political changes in the atmosphere too. Like just because you have a kid doesn't mean that like people who operate outside of that are a threat to your child or your child's safety and health. So it's definitely goes bigger than just like what you and I experience. You know?
Well, and also it kind of underscores the importance of like, it is important to have parents and child-free people in the world because different things to society.
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk a bit about some phrases you might hear in your comments or, you know, those out there might hear from their parents or their friends and like just things that when you choose to be childless, come up all the time. First is the idea of regret. You will regret not having kids. You're going to be 60 and you're going to be like, I'm all alone. Yeah. What do you say to like that kind of line of thinking that you see so often?
I feel like there's like a bunch of different ways you can respond to this. And of course, the immediate one that I think pops to most people's minds is like, well, you can also regret having kids. There's a whole child regret Reddit, like a whole Reddit thread of like, there's Facebook groups dedicated to people who regret having kids. Like it does happen. I think people don't want to admit that it happens because it's definitely, I mean, it's very controversial. It definitely feels very wrong. Like everybody should want to have kids. And so when you have kids and you don't like it, feels like there's something wrong with you. Right off the bat, it's like potential for regret goes either way. I always think of it as like, people are so afraid of regret. I feel like they've turned regret into this like big all-consuming thing that means you have failed. If you have regrets, then your life has been a failure. And it's like regret is just an emotion, which it is real, like you feel it, but it is just like sadness or joy or anger. It is an emotion. It is temporary. And everybody will have regrets in life. Like that is this whole concept of like live so you don't have regrets. It's not possible. But I think it's because we fear regret so much. We pretend like we can live a life without regrets, but it's just not possible. You know, like I regret taking out as much student loans as I did. For example,
yes,
I regret not cutting my wedding cake sooner in my wedding because it was at the end of the night and a lot of people had left and I had a shit ton of wedding cake left over. I know those are like maybe kind of small, funny examples, but it's just to the point of like people go to college and then have no interest in pursuing what they studied. And although they might not say, oh, well, I regret studying that in college, I'm going to assume they do because unless your college was paid for, like 4 years that you could view as being wasted. In my mind, regret is just a learning tool. So it's just kind of like, you know, essentially, if you do something and you regret it, you learn from it. Like you learn moving forward. I want to do something, you know, more in line with my values. And so say you're 60 and you're looking back and you're like, you know what? I regret not having kids. Okay. You regret not having kids, but you didn't have them. You move on. I mean, and you could just focus on it and let that consume your whole life if you wanted to, but you could also just recognize it as like, it's something I didn't do. That was a choice I made. I'm going to focus on all the things that I do have or that I do enjoy, you know, the life that I have created. And you can appreciate your life and still see things that you missed out on. Because again, like you're just not going to do it all.
Yeah. And I like the way you put regret as an emotion. And it's just like other emotions, like, you know, a really strong one as well is like loneliness. Like you are going to feel alone and lonely in every situation in your life, no matter what kids the makeup of people are there, whether you're coupled, whether you have kids, whether you have dogs, like those are feelings that are going to come up. And there's nothing you can do to stop them from coming. They are part of you and the cycle of emotions you go through. And yeah, all you can do is work on it, work on yourself, go see a therapist if you need some extra help. And
totally.
Okay, because I regret not conditioning Queenie to get her nails cut.
There you go.
She is terrible now and it is a huge effort and it therefore doesn't happen. But it is what it is. I have a girl in front of me now that won't get her nails cut and I have to sedate her to do it. It is what it is.
Yeah. And I think people also tend to think that like, if you regret something, it means it was wrong. I don't know. As a culture, we are so obsessed with right and wrong, which carries very strong moral connotations. But it's like, no, there's plenty of things you can do that you might regret, but you still appreciate how things are now. So like, as a great example, I do sometimes regret adopting a dog so soon after Mia had passed away, because it sort of set up some unfair comparisons for June where like, I was missing what I had with Mia and like expecting to have that same connection with June was just very unfair, but I don't regret getting June at all. You know what I mean? So it's like, you can also, you know, regret not having kids, be like, but I'm so grateful for the life I do have. And same thing, other like parents who do regret having kids, you can regret having kids and still do the best that you can.
Be an amazing parent.
And still appreciate the life that you create, even if you regret having kids. It doesn't have to be this like, well, my whole life is now a failure. Like I'm 60 years old and wish I had had kids. What a waste. That's such a gross oversimplification of life.
Well, let's go with, yeah, the loneliness aspect. Like, again, thinking about yourself at like 60, 70, 80, like if you don't have kids, who's going to be by your deathbed? Who's going to be taking care of you? You'll die alone. What are you going to do?
Oh, God. Yeah, this happened when I was on a social media break for the month of September. When I decided to finally come back, I had put up a question of like, oh, ask me anything. Like, you have any questions about my break, whatever.
Left it too open there. I saw it and I was like, uh-oh.
Somebody asked, like, are you ever afraid that you're going to die alone? And I want to clarify, I don't know if this person was asking it in like an accusing way. Like a lot of people ask me this because they are child free. And they hear this a lot and they are worried about it, where they're like, should I, like, is this something you worry about? Like, people tell me all the time, I'm going to die alone. And so whoever this person is, like, I'm not saying that they were doing it out of spite, but I got asked this question of like, are you ever afraid you're going to die alone? And I always think this question is funny to me because I'm not sure what, I think it means different things to different people, because the reality is, unless you're in some kind of like horrific group accident, like a bus wreck or a ship sinks or something, like you're going to die alone. Ideally, you are the only person in the room dying, right? Like you don't want to go down with a bunch of people with you. The actual action of dying is always alone. And a lot of times if you're dying old, sometimes people aren't even really cognizant of people being in the room with them. That whole idea of being with somebody when they pass, I think is more for the living than it is for the person dying, is one thing. I also think another fear people have is this idea of like, I'm going to die in my house and no one's going to know for like 10 days until the smell just gets so bad. And some, you know, like one of those kind of stories. And that is really just like, well, it just depends on the community that you build. And so having kids is not a guaranteed community. I think that's a very dangerous perspective that like, because I have a child, they are beholden to me for the rest of my life. Like it is their obligation to care for me, is a really dangerous idea. And a lot of parents will be like, well, my kids will want to take care of me. Like I wanted to take care of my parents when they got old, my kids will want to take care of me. And I'm like, great. If that is what your goal is, I'm going to assume you are fostering that long-term relationship. Like you said, you know, you're in your 30s and you're still fostering that relationship with your parents. I am too. Like then that becomes a lifelong relationship, which is not exclusive to parents and children. Like you can create community with friends, with spouses, with your neighborhood. You can create a community to where you will not die and nobody misses you. I think that's where a lot of that fear comes from, is that like, oh, like nobody's going to find me in my house for 10 days because nobody will notice that I'm gone for 10 days. I think that's what people fear, which has nothing to do with having kids.
And what's interesting too is just like the changes that come with like that dynamic of like, my kids will take care of me, etc. They're cultural. A lot of white households don't have that dynamic where a sick parent or an old parent will move into the home with the spouse. That's, for example, my mom, she's Indian, and that has been like an expectation she's had to just realize like, oh, not only are my kids not really wanting me to move in, they can't afford to have me move in because we can barely afford a house. How can I afford to have my mom live with me in her old age? There's a lot to come there that has nothing to do with like how much you care for your parents, how much your kids love you. There's literally like economic stuff going on with everyone. Everything's more expensive. If you live in a city, you probably live in an apartment with roommates. Yeah. You don't have a spouse. You and your spouse barely have space for the two of you. It's not the same thing that it was like generations ago. And
absolutely.
Weird expectation to put on your kid when you don't even know what their future is going to look like.
Yeah, and there's also a host of other struggles that can come with aging, like memory loss or illness, terminal illness, that like a child may not be equipped to deal with. Like even as an adult, my mom and her sisters at the end of my grandfather's life, my grandfather and grandmother. My grandmother passed away first. My grandfather stayed. He never left his house. Like he died in the hospital, but it was only because he like got an injury and ended up like he never went to a home or anything like that. So taxing on my mom and my aunts because they were constantly concerned about him. They always had to check in on him. Like they would have felt, you know, it was a big house. They had to pay somebody to maintain the yard, pay somebody to clean. I think they realized, they were like, we would feel so much better if he was in a smaller space, surrounded by a community taking care of him, like in a home. And I think people have this concept of nursing homes as like, where you send old people to forget about them, which I'm sure those still exist. And I think that was a really common thing. But, you know, my husband's an architect and one of his jobs was all senior living communities. And these, I mean, I know that they're expensive, but like, they're freaking dope. It's like going back to college. Okay. I think being around people your own age is really great. You have the same issues. There's, you know, people always talk about like, oh, I like talking about my depression online because so many people are like, oh my God, I'm going through that exact same experience. And that connection is so meaningful. I think it's the same thing for like old people. Like, I broke my hip last year. I know what a pain in the ass it is. You know what I mean?
I've had friends who've had, you know, their grandparents really, really hesitant to make these moves. I think, you know, think of it from a prideful perspective or again, these expectations. But, you know, like you've said repeatedly, community is underrated. And obviously, yes, there are nursing homes. I know there's plenty in Canada that like aren't operating well, et cetera, et cetera. But that's why we need social services to just like...
Exactly.
Well, so that people can form communities with less barriers and just, you know, be able to not just have their children bear 100% of like their life and their future. It's a lot to put on your kids.
And even being like caring for an aging parent, knowing like, oh, dad is saying that he is dizzy. Like, do we need to go to the hospital? Is he okay? Like, you have to make those calls versus if they're in a community where there's like a nurse on standby or they have facilities there. Like, it's such a much more of a peace of mind. And so I know like my mom and her sisters literally talked about, you know, when we get old, our plan now is we're going to find a home. Like, we are not putting our kids through this because it is such a burden. And it is a privilege to be able to afford places like this. But like you said, like, that is why community is so important.
That's also great that your parents are being proactive about you and your sisters and what you'll have to deal with, because that is something that I think is a bit of a generational gap and, you know, very, like, let's not talk about this. Let's not talk about that.
If we don't invest more in communities, we will get to a point where people cannot afford to take care of their parents. Like, we're kind of at that point now, like you were saying, but I mean, at some point, like, it's not going to just be, well, the millennial generation nobody will be, like, only the super wealthy will have the privilege of caring for their parents, because you literally, like you said, you won't have a room for them to sleep in. Like, you can't pay for their medicine. Like, you can't be at home to monitor them because you have to go to work. You know, this is a problem, like the whole, like, you'll die alone is a problem that literally parents and non-parents will have to face alike. Being with your kids is not always a feasible option. And I would like to think that parents who really care about their kids don't want to place that burden on them anyways.
Let's bring it back to dogs. So I think another one is, again, that comparison. How can you compare your love for your dogs
to
the beautiful love of parents and children or moms and their kids, et cetera, et cetera. I think if you're, you know, a woman or a woman presenting or have the ability to birth, it is always a bit more pressure on you as well there.
You know, I have a blog post that talks about how the patriarchy shows up in dog culture. And I think a lot about how the patriarchy shows up in different spheres of our life. So dog culture is one of them, but it is a very patriarchal value to have an order and a hierarchy to things. And it is a patriarchal value to be at the top of that hierarchy. Like, power is, you know, that you want to be at the top and in control of everything underneath. And I think because we live in such a patriarchal society, people always want to be the best. They want their experience to be the best experience and to be at the top. I can imagine being pregnant and giving birth to a child and raising a child. I'm sure that is an incredibly special relationship, especially if it's something that you want and you are invested in. And I'm sure it's very unique. Like, I wouldn't know because I've never given birth, but being special or unique, or, you know, that being a very powerful bond does not make it better or worse than other relationships. Because, like, what is better or worse? Like, I mean, some people would say, well, the biological connection you have is more powerful than anything you can experience. But other people would say, well, isn't it more powerful when that relationship is based on choice as opposed to biology? And so it's like, you know, it's very
subjective. Of course, a lot of people who want children don't give birth or adopt or, you know, foster children. And like,
not even including adoptive parents. I do think that there's something special about the parent-child relationship for sure. You know, I do think it's beautiful and magical that people with uteruses can give life to other people. Like, that is pretty freaking cool, but it's not, you know, better or worse. And so I think about, people are always like, well, you'll never know true love unless you have a baby. And it's like, That's such a sad statement. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's so many people that I love. Like, I love my parents. I love my sisters, my aunts and uncles. I love my husband. I love my dogs. I love my niece and my nephews. Like, are you saying that, like, that doesn't count? And then, yeah. And then if you're like, well, it's biological. Adoptive parents don't count. Step parents don't count.
like you said, it's also about ranking your relationships, which in and of itself is strange. Like, you know,
yes.
I think, you know, we'll maybe talk about this a bit later, but even just like the idea of like romantic love and how it's perpetrated and like your friendships are so life forming and just like make you who you are in so many ways. Obviously, there's so many folks out there who don't have like good relationships with their families and have to create their own. And like, again, it's about community, and community is building love and like strong relationships of all shapes and sizes to make you
a
good person.
Yeah. And, you know, bringing this back to dogs, like, again, I love that you said like ranking relationships is really weird, because when you do think about it too much, it like, I would never compare like the love I have for my husband with the love I have for my parents. Like, they're not comparable. Like, they're just not the same thing. They're just different relationships, and one's not better or stronger than the other. And like, even if you were like, well, if you had to choose one or the other, who would you choose? That's not based on love. There's way more variables that would go into that decision. But bringing it back to dogs, I think about like, you know, when you adopt a dog or buy a dog, like, you choose to care for them. So you are in charge of feeding them and exercising them and making sure that they are happy. And that takes a lot of time and intention. And that bond, I mean, like, it is literally proven by science. Like, there are scientific studies that show the same hormones that, you know, a mother gets looking upon her child are the same hormones that a dog owner gets looking upon their dog. So it's like, scientifically, there's not a difference there. And again, it really goes back to like we said at the beginning, like, of course, raising a dog is very different than raising a child. That's why I have chosen to raise a dog and not children. The science is the same as far as love goes, but obviously there are differences. And again, it's not that one is better or worse or stronger or weaker. It's just different.
It all just exists.
And why are you going to judge what other people love? If people are like, I love my books more than anything, if that's what brings them joy and makes them happy, then like, why are you going to be like, well, that's not real love? Like, that's such a shitty thing. Like, we need more love in this world. Like, don't shit on other people's loves just because it's not your love.
Similarly, I found this a lot, even with dog people. Why do you think people hate the terms like dog mom, dog dad, dog parent?
Oh gosh. People who have kids think it's kind of like a form of appropriation or like disrespect that we're comparing the two roles. I think people who don't have kids are very aware of like, I have dogs, not kids, because I don't want kids. I'm not a mom. I am a dog owner. Like, I don't want to have kids. So I see both sides of that, I don't know, spectrum, I guess. But for me, I think of terms like mom or dad, like mother, father, parent as roles, as opposed to identities. So like, to me, like a parent or a mother, like that is a caretaker role. It is a role who will guide and help grow something. So that's why I like plant mom or dog mom. Like, those terms resonate with me. I have also heard people who are like, I want women to be able to get away from the need to be called a mother. Like, women can identify with more than just being a mother. And I totally respect that. But again, I think it comes back to your personal values. So if the term like dog mom or dog dad does not resonate with you, don't use it. Like, I totally understand, like, don't use it. But at the same time, like, it's weird to then go around and police how other people use it, even with parents who are like, well, it's not like a real mom. And it's like, okay, well, what is a real mom? Like, if you start trying to dig into that definition where it's like, oh, well, it's somebody who has a child. Okay, well, what does it mean to have a child? Does it have to, like, why does it have to be human? Like, and if to you, that is an inherent part of the definition, great, that's your definition. But like, you can't then come to me and be like, well, you have to have my definition of mom for it to be the right definition.
Yes, or in general, just giving judgment, like people who call themselves dog moms are like this. Like, I find a lot of people will make assumptions, which also in general, you know, I always say, like, there was a period in time where being like a basic was like had a lot of connotations to it. And people kind of are like, oh, I'm cooler than the basic. But sometimes we all just want to be a little basic and just silly and playful. Like,
and why do
I love calling
it?
Myself a dog mom? Because it's fucking funny to me. I don't know why. I literally just today made a stupid joke about birthing my dog because to me, it's so funny. And I say it, I've said it on first date because I'm like, this is the type of weird humor you're going to hear. Is like, you know, they'll say like, oh, cute dog. And I'll say like, oh, thank you. I made her myself.
Yeah. And like thank you. I birthed her myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
She takes after me.
She has all my DNA. And it's so stupid, but like,
it's very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. And also if people take it seriously and actually like, I'm a dedicated dog mom. I love that too, because if they're taking good care of their dog,
if that's what makes you happy. Yeah. Really, this kind of goes back to like not wanting to police what makes people happy. And also there's this weird gatekeeping of the term mother is like, holier, like elevated role, which I think has its own problems. My assumption is there are plenty of parents of human children who were like, I mean, I think the term dog mom is stupid, but like, I don't give a shit if somebody calls themselves a dog. Like, that's the attitude. Like, you can think it's stupid. I don't care. But you don't need to be like, well, you can't do that. Like, why you gotta police my joy? If it brings me joy, makes me laugh, why do you want to prevent that? Like, why do you want to control that?
Yeah, you can think people are stupid. I'm not saying like I'm completely non-judgmental. I love judging people, but I don't take it seriously. I don't think my judgmentalness is real.
I certainly don't feel compelled to go on to other people's social media and preach my own judgment.
Did we miss any big hate comments that you typically get or any like?
Oh, I mean, one of the common themes that I hear a lot is people get kind of vengeful about people not wanting kids. So they'll say things like, well, we don't want you contributing to the population anyways, or, well, that's because nobody wants to have sex with you. Or like as though the only way you could not want kids is because you yourself are so undesirable. It's such a hilarious, hilariously absurd thing for me to hear from people, because like I am married and the whole like you don't want to like we don't want you contributing to the gene pool anyways, like, okay, well, like, I don't know how to break this to you, but I have two sisters who have kids, so
sorry, my DNA is the gene pool.
Those comments also baffle me, because I'm like, what about me saying I don't want kids makes you so angry and hate me so much immediately that you're like, I don't want you to reproduce? Like, that's a pretty, I think people say that kind of flippantly, but like, that's a pretty strong sentence.
Yeah. And I think it's like, you don't know any of my other value systems. You don't know anything about me. Yeah. And it's a judgment on like a lot more than just your choice.
And you're over here like, well, thank God you're not reproducing. And it's like, wow.
Yeah, no, that's intense. And also, of course, the classic, like, you know, being a woman or femme presenting on the internet and just being like, oh, you're ugly, you're this, that's this. And it's just like this emphasis, first of all, that appearances have anything to do with sex is just stupid in and of itself. And then, yeah, like you said, you're married. Yeah, it's just so stupid.
Nothing is more telling to me than like a man who's like, well, you just don't want kids because nobody will have sex with you. I'm like, honestly, I wouldn't care. Like, to be totally like, you're right, I don't want kids. So if it came down to having sex and having kids or never having sex, I would rather never have sex again because I don't want to have kids. So to me, this what those kind of comments tell me is that the person commenting, that is such a huge value for them. Like this idea of desirability or getting laid is like, if you don't get laid, you're a loser. And if you get laid, that's how you're a winner in life. And I'm like, I am so sorry you have such a narrow definition of success.
Oh man, you don't even know when you are single and people are mad at you. It is a very favorite tool of people to bring to the table. And it's really ridiculous.
Like, I don't know how to explain this to people, but like, sex is just not that big of a deal. Like, yes, it's great, but it's just not. Like, life goes on, my friends. There are other options out there.
And desirability and sex are not connected. Like, you know, 80-year-old people have sex and we don't view them as desirable. Fat people have sex, even though you might not view them as desirable, but many do. too. It is just so dumb.
Yeah. Anytime I get like an especially hateful comment, because some comments like you'll regret it or you're going to die alone, to me, those are really ignorant comments, like people who haven't taken that thought to its end, like hasn't really thought through it. Oh, I'm glad you're not contributing to the gene pool, or it's because nobody wants you. Those thoughts, which are just like pure troll hate comments. The only thing I can think about is how much I pity the person commenting, because I'm like, either you truly believe this, which I am so sad that you're like, your life is defined by these values, because you must feel so unvalued.
There's no way to feel good about yourself if those are your value systems.
Totally.
It's a cycle that makes you like, you're always going to feel undesired if you think desirability is super important, because you can't be desired 24/7.
Yeah.
Even if you're in a relationship.
By everybody. Or by everybody, right? Like this idea that like everybody has to find you desirable. Like that's absurd. Or yeah, that desirability and sex are like the same thing, because there's more to desire than just like a sexual desire, right? Like I feel very lucky because I'm able to sort of brush those comments off and kind of laugh at how absurd they are. But I always worry about people who are more vulnerable in their decision to not have kids, or who are more on the fence or aren't sure, because like those comments can make a really negative impact.
Young people on your page, you know, like just again, we are lucky that we're a little older and have the, you know, strength and experience to just brush these things off.
That's a, like what's really important to me about having my blog and my page and to talk about this, even though it like, I know that it's going to raise up shitty comments. Like I know, and anytime I post something about being happily child-free, I know it's going to get at least one shitty comment, probably more. But I do it because for every shitty comment, I have people who usually they DM me because they're not comfortable posting publicly. And they say things like, I'm a young person, like, you know, I'm 22 and I don't think that I want to have kids, but I've never seen an example of what that looks like. And seeing your page is really inspiring. Like, thank you for showing what a life without kids or without children can look like. Or people who are older and are like, I've never wanted kids and I've always heard these things. And it's really nice to see somebody who's just like owning it and not ashamed. And so like, I do get a lot of those comments. And I think about the reality of regretting having kids is really hard. Like it is, like I said, you can regret having kids and still live a very full life and just, you know, move forward. But that's got to be really hard, because it is something that you are then with the rest of your life, right? If it's presented more as a choice, you're less likely to wind up with people who regret having kids, because when people see that you don't have to have kids, or that's not just like an inevitability, or what you should do, it's the right decision, you know, then people can choose like, actually, I want to make my impact elsewhere. Like I want to do something else with my life. Or you have people who are like, no, like raising kids, that is the impact I want to have. And then you can kind of get almost like a like double down on that dedication. But people need to know it's a choice, and that both choices are great. Both choices are fulfilling, valuable. They leave an impact on society. Like that's another idea, is that like, oh, you'll never have a legacy. Like you'll never, you know, what will your legacy be if you don't have kids? And it's like, well, there's other ways you can make an impact besides birthing a human being or even raising a human being. People being able to see that both having kids or not having kids, I think just it makes it happier for everybody. Parents are more fulfilled because they feel in alignment with their values. People without kids feel more fulfilled because they're aligned with their values. And then you have people who wanted kids and can't have kids. Yeah. And instead of being this like thing you pity, or like, well, I'm so sorry that you were denied this crucial part of a happy life, you know, we'll just feel sorry for, instead of like that story, you can be like, okay, well, I can see, even if I don't have kids, I can still make an impact somewhere else.
Yeah. Or I can just live a happy life and, you know, enjoy everything it has to offer. So
living a happy life is making an impact. I think did is live in your own joy. That is a legacy.
I agree. I think also, like you were saying, like people who might be making the decision based on pressure versus based on the emotional feelings. I think also neutralizing the idea of having kids or not helps people make a more informed decision about the commitment. Yeah. You know, we always encourage with people getting dogs, like this is how much work it's going to be. This is how much it's going to cost. This is how much vet care costs in your city. Like be conscious of all that. And I think obviously it sucks to some degree, because being poor and owning a dog is like really hard in the city, and nobody should be be denied like the idea of pet ownership. But unfortunately, we live in a capitalistic society that makes it hard to not make a certain amount of money and be able to do that. Kids are the same thing, but unfortunately, they're not treated as such. And there's this pressure to have kids without the social resources to actually support parents. God. That's what sucks. Like, I think, you know, you could choose to be a parent because you want to, and everybody has access to making children. Obviously, you have throughout history. But in today's world, like, you know, daycare is a certain like implication. School's a certain implication. Where you live, your parental structure or your community. Do you have people around you to support you? Like, those are all really important aspects of having kids that you can plan for to at least feel supported in whatever next step of your journey is. Like, even with my dog. I'm so happy I have like friends who have dogs that, you know, need support or need a buddy, or somebody will reach out to me and be like, my dog really doesn't like other dogs. And I'll be like, yeah, let's go on a neutral walk and just see how things go. Like, I'm sure there's extreme amount of equivalence for kids, you know, that there's people out there that are like you and like can help you and support you. But it's hard when a lot of those things have financial barriers and economic barriers and political barriers. So
we're just turning this into a social justice podcast now.
Yeah. That's just my vibe, honestly.
But thinking about, like, I do think about how kids can be weaponized against communities. So like, if you come from a very privileged and wealthy background, kids are such a privilege and joy to have because you have access to all of these things. And they are a way to, like, you know, do better for the next generation and like watch your kids grow and thrive. Whereas if you come from a very under-resourced space, right, whether it's financial or you don't have a community or whatever, kids can be weaponized against you. They're a way to keep people poor and to keep people isolated and to keep people from having community, because kids become this sort of like all-encompassing burden. And what an easy way to guilt somebody, right? Of like, well, you should be a better parent, or you should be doing this for your kid, or you should be working harder. And like, if you're so busy trying to like figure out how to raise a kid because you can't afford your bill, like how can you ever grow? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like this whole idea of like, you have to have kids and it's the right thing to do is such a dangerous narrative, and can be like reinforce the privilege. Who has the right of raising happy, healthy kids? And then who is sort of like ends up in this position of like being stuck because they had kids when they didn't want kids, and now they're trying to figure out how to take care of them.
It's all interwoven. And again, it just reinforces like, it's a complicated decision, and you 100% know what you want, and you're putting it out there. And for some reason, that's controversial. But really,
I know.
It's okay. Other people will have kids.
Oh, yeah. And, you know I have parents who follow me because they think my content is funny, or that they relate to the dog side of it. Like, right, they're people who have kids and who have dogs, because they are happy in their decision to have kids. They don't feel threatened when I'm like, I love not having kids, because they're like, that's great for you. I love having kids. And both of these things can be true. And I think it's always the people who are like, if I'm like, I love not having kids, and somebody feels threatened by that, I think it's because there's a twinge of regret. What is it that's prompting them to get defensive? Because there are plenty of parents who are like, nope, yep, raising kids, hardest thing I've ever done. I love it. And I would never change that for the world. But if you don't want to don't do it because it's hard.
I've had many parents say that to me, and it's just like, yeah, it's okay to admit that. I'd love to wrap this up maybe talking about, kind of in general, you know, no matter what your situation is, like, I think the biggest emphasis you have is, you know, building of community and doing things for yourself. What advice do you have for those who are just trying to get by with their dogs and have like judgment around them, whether they're single or in a relationship, have kids or not? Like, how do you navigate this like complicated internet landscape that we're in?
Oh God, it's hard, especially on the internet. I don't know. I think it's less navigating and more like bumper cars, where you're just always going to be bumping into people who will judge you for something. Like, no matter how much research or effort you put into something, you'll be judged for something. It's just a reality, and something that I am working hard on personally, but is very difficult, and no doubt will be a lifelong journey, is learning to find value internally instead of finding value externally. Someone's not quite sure what that means. Like, instead of like taking on value based on how other people feel about you, which as like a people pleaser, and especially as a woman raised in a patriarchal society where like so much of our value is determined by other people, learning to be like, I don't care what other people think. And I know people say that all the time, like, oh, just don't care about what other people think. And it's not as easy as that. Like, there, because I mean, at the end of the day, like, you got to care what your boss thinks, right? For your job, you kind of care what your friends and family think if you love them, because that's a two-way relationship there. So it's not as easy as just not caring. Something that was really helpful for me was defining my values. So literally I printed off like this massive list of a bunch of values. Like, they were just a bunch of words, cut them out so that they were all individuals. And I went through all of them and I selected ones that kind of stood out to me. I started with like 200 and I took it down to like 25 and then down to like 10. And this was done like over weeks. And then I finally ended up with like a, you know, I think it's maybe 8 core values that are things that are really important to me, like curiosity, connection, adventure, compassion. And whenever I am confronted with like a decision that I'm really uncertain on, or I feel pressure from other people or judgment, like even in on my Instagram, and if people get really upset about me posting about like being happily child free, and I start to feel like a little guilty or like, oh, am I making people feel bad? I kind of go back to my values and think like, is this aligning with my values? And if the answer is yes, then I can rest assured that I'm living my best life, regardless of, you know, how other people think. And it's not about what other people think. And then the next step of that is learning that like my values are different from your values. So while I might value compassion, somebody else might value efficiency. And those aren't the same things, right? And it's like, one's not better than the other. Again, that's like the theme of this whole podcast episode, is like, it's not better or worse. And so it's definitely a journey trying to like navigate that judgment and not let it just make you feel like a horrible person. But I think if you can really start to define your values and literally like write the word, what it means to you, what the definition is, how does it show up in your life? That really helps kind of provide like a compass, if you will, while navigating the chaos that is the internet and life in general.
And I love that, because I think, you know, the whole idea of like, don't care what people say about you, it's too like broad. You know, sometimes people will have just criticism or say something that is not something you've thought about, but that could align with your values overall, that you can add to your spectrum of thinking. And then obviously, yeah, there's a lot of people out there who might think, you know, I always think this for myself, like if I obsess over someone and like, oh my God, do they find me annoying? Do they not like me? And it's just like, but like, why does that matter? I don't like some people either. And that's okay. Yeah. Like, there's nothing wrong with being disliked by someone who is not part of your, who doesn't affect your life, basically, especially when it comes to staying on the internet or, you know, people in your circle of friends or circle of people. And yeah, and I think a value system is always a really good thing to hold on to, because those things shape everything in your life, your relationships, how you tackle conflict, how you tackle hard moments.
Remembering too, especially when you encounter judgmental people, that like if somebody dislikes you because of a decision you like, say, because you've chosen not to have kids, you don't want them in your life anyways. And again, it's not that they're like some horrible person, but it's like, that's not the person you want to surround yourself with. Like, people tend, again, it goes back to this hierarchy of like, you can be like, this person does not need to be in my life, and not be like, well, it's because they're a horrible human being and like, I'm so much better than them. Like, it's just, no, you just have different values. And like, a relationship, like a friendship, then if it doesn't give you anything, there's all this idea of like, take what you need and like release what doesn't serve you. That is such a like new age sounding thing, but it's so true. Like, a friendship may not serve you, and that's okay. Like, that doesn't mean it's bad or the other person's bad. It just doesn't serve you. But there are friendships that will serve you and that will fill your cup and align with your values. And those are the, you know, the relationships that you put work into and you keep, and you don't have to worry so much about, you know, someone's opinion, critiques.
Assholes on the internet, basically.
Yeah, aka assholes on the internet.
Well, thank you for having this discussion with me. I think just a good way too for me to be just like, oh yeah, I'm diving back into this world. Yeah. Lots going on, and you know, It's a good way to just approach being dog Instagrammers on the internet.
Here's a word of advice. If people do leave really mean comments, my favorite thing to do is figure out a way to like compliment them. If nothing else, if somebody leaves a mean comment that I have nothing to say to, I'm just like, hey, thanks so much for giving my content a boost. Or like, oh, thank you. Like, even though you really didn't like this post, I really appreciate you taking the time to like engage with it. Like that really helps my content. Thanks so much. Because I can guarantee you nothing will piss somebody off more.
I love that.
And the more they comment, if they try to fight you on it, thank you so much. I really appreciate the engagement. And eventually they stop because the more they comment, the more the algorithm is going to appreciate your comments.
Well, that's the funny thing is the hater comments make more haters see them, which is ridiculous. Yeah. I think I've seen you give like stats and stuff, which is so fun. I always see you just being like, oh, did you know that this many people are happy in childhood situations?
Yeah. Did you know that a recent study showed that the majority of child-free people don't regret their decision to not have kids?
Love
the science is out there.
Exactly. I would love for you to share your website and maybe some recent blog posts that you've put on there.
People can find me, of course, on Instagram at the Dink Dog Mom or at my blog, which is thedinkdogmom.com. Some of my recent posts, I just posted about comparing dog nail grinders to dog nail clippers. And spoiler alert, having both is really helpful. But I also have a recipe for Tinto de Verano, which is kind of like a sangria, but a lot cheaper and easier to make. So that's super fun. And I think another recent post I have is about setting boundaries with your dog, which is also kind of goes into like the broader importance of setting boundaries in any relationship.
Definitely setting boundaries with dogs is harder to do sometimes, but necessary.
Also respecting the boundaries that your dog sets for you, because boundaries are a two-way street. And so, I think people, number one, I am very guilty of this, where it's like, I never want to take a walk without my dog because I always feel guilty. Like I always feel like I should be taking my dog for a walk, but sometimes I deserve to take a walk, especially if it's like, if I want to walk for exercise, I can't stop every 2 seconds for my dogs to sniff something. And so setting that boundary and, you know, it's an important part of your mental health. But at the same time, then, you know, my dogs, when I do walk with them, I do let them sniff because that's their boundary. Like if they're going to go for a walk, they want to be able to sniff all the disgusting things on the ground.
That's exactly right. I think dogs give you a lot of boundaries, so why not set some back? Queenie loves licking my face, and sometimes I gotta be like, girl,
nope,
I just did my skincare. Leave me alone.
Yes, this is expensive product. I want it to stay on my face.
Also don't know what's in it, so please stop. Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing and thanks for coming back. Be my first official interview for season 4. Thanks, Blair. It was great chatting with you and hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thanks so much. It was great being here.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can follow the Rescue Dog Love podcast on Instagram at Rescue Dog Love Pod. You can also find old episodes on our website, rescuedoglove.com, on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Google Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and review the pod. Every time we get a good review, Queenie gets an extra special treat. Till next time.